ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरोन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः नमः ॐ विष्णुपदाय कृष्णप्रेष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्त स्वामी निट्ठी नामिने नमस्ते सरस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेषा संयवादी अस्त्यदेशधारिणे नमो महापदन्याय कृष्ण प्रेम प्रदायते कृष्णाय कृष्ण चैतन्य नामने गौरपिशे नमः हे कृष्ण करुणा सिंधु दीनाबंधु जगतपते गोपेशा गोपिका कांता राधा कंदन मोस्तुते I am very grateful, very honored, and very happy to be with all of you today. This world-renowned institution of Intel. Thank you for being with us. I was asked to speak on the subject of growing through adversity. Once my beloved spiritual teacher wrote that a person's greatness has to be estimated by how we tolerate provoking situations. We see this through history, that those who have achieved the most and who have affected the world are people who didn't diminish in challenging times, but learned how to see the opportunity to grow. Winston Churchill said that success is when we go through failure after failure after failure and never give up the enthusiasm to succeed. I'd like to share a simple story with you of someone who just a few years ago I met for the first time. In 2012, there was an event in Mumbai where I heard about this person. It was International Women's Day. And that year, there were some rape cases that made world news in India. And there was mass demonstrations of thousands of people in Delhi and other parts of India, demanding something be done about the injustices to helpless women. So considering that, this event was very significant. It was in an auditorium of a college. Dignitaries attended. Corporate heads, educators, government officials, business people. The keynote speaker was a 63-year-old lady in a simple Indian sari. Her name was Sindhu Thai Samkal. When she told the story of her life, all the hundreds of people there were weeping together. May I share with you that story?
Yes.
She was born in a very simple village in the state of Maharashtra. Very poor family. When she was a little girl, 5, 6 years old, she really wanted to go to school because no one in her family had ever been educated. But her parents, they made her take care of a small herd of water buffalo instead. So this little 6-year-old girl with a little stick was herding these gigantic water buffaloes, taking them to different little forests and pastures. And eventually, she would take them to a pond of water where they would submerge themselves up to their neck, and she would run to school. She really wanted to learn something. But because she was late for school, almost every day, the teacher would beat her with a stick. And when she'd go back after taking a couple classes, sometimes the water buffaloes had left the pond of water and were in somebody else's fields, and that person would beat her with sticks. She explained these were the best years of her childhood. When she was not even 10 years old, still 9, she was forced to get married to a 30-year-old man. And by the time she was 19 years old, she had 3 sons and was pregnant with a 4th child. At that time, in their little village, there was a very criminal-minded person, a local mafia man, who was really exploiting. He was forcing the village ladies to practically work slave labor for him under an amazing amount of threat. And nobody dared to say a word about it. But Sindhu Thai told the local collector about him, and that local collector stopped him from his activities. But that criminal was so angry, he wanted revenge. He told Sindhu Thai's husband a lie. He said, "Your wife is having affairs with so many men, including me. And you should know that she's not pregnant with your child. She's pregnant with my child. And if you don't do something about her, I'll do something to you." The husband was so furious, he decided to kill his own wife. He kicked her in the abdomen again and again and again until she laid on the ground unconscious. And he dragged her to a cow shed that was overcrowded with all sorts of bulls and oxen and cows, buffaloes, thinking that the people would just assume that she was trampled to death. There was a cow, and this cow took pity on her and stood over her with all 4 of her legs, and would not let any other animal or human come near this little girl laying down. The cow with her horns was chasing everybody away for many hours. Sindhu Thai came to consciousness and saw Now the cow was protecting her. It was under that cow that she gave birth to a daughter. Laying close by, there was a rock that had kind of a sharp edge, and she had to cut her own umbilical cord. And for hours, under the protection of that cow, her and her little infant baby survived. When she had enough strength, she embraced the cow. She cried, and she promised the cow, "Someday, I will give my life to help the helpless." But where was she going to go? She went to her own biological home, but because of some tradition they had, they would not allow a daughter who was married to come back to their own home. She was rejected. She was on her own. She resided at a crematorium where on the bank of a river, under the open sky, human bodies were burned. Because she felt that if she stayed there, people would think she was haunted and leave her alone. She explained at that meeting that she would gather some wheat flour from various places, and at times she would cook chapatis with the fire of burning human corpses. After some weeks, she decided that life was just too painful, and she didn't want her little daughter to grow up in this way. So she finally made that decision, for with her daughter, she would give up her life. In the middle of the night, she went to a railway track and laid on the track holding her baby, waiting for a train to end her life. She heard somebody wailing in pain, and somehow or other that really connected to her heart. And she went and saw an old man who was dying, who was crying in hunger and thirst. And she went and got some water for him and begged some food and brought it back to him. And she explained at this lecture that she was giving in the auditorium that at that moment, through that old man, she heard the voice of God calling her to keep her promise to the cow to help those who are helpless. She really didn't know what to do. Later that day, she was laying under a tree with her little baby, wondering, "I'm so broken. How can I help anybody?" Then she looked up and saw from the tree there was a branch that was brutally chopped by a woodsman. And that branch was just hanging by a single shred. But it was giving her and her baby shade from the scorching noonday sun. And it was then that she understood, however she has been hurt, she can still make a difference to others, and her life would have deep meaning and purpose. She decided that I'm going to be the mother for the homeless orphans. And there's no shortage of those in India. She would go to railway stations and other places and collect little children who were completely forsaken by society, who had no real alternative except to become criminals, to work child labor, or to become beggars under some mafia. And she took these little kids, and she learned how to sing, and she'd go to railway platforms and sing and collect money and feed them and somehow find some place that was relatively safe. And gradually more and more children were finding shelter in her. And some pious people witnessing this, they got a little property and built an orphanage for her. And she became known as the mother of the orphans. In course of time, years, she's had over 1,500 children that she was a mother for. Thousands more who she's a grandmother for. And all these children get an education. Some are doctors, engineers, farmers, lawyers, professors. What she was never given as a child, she wanted to give to them. Over the years, she's been given 270 national and international awards. She's been invited to 15 countries. All the sons of her previous husband, they all left him to join her. Two of them have PhDs. One of them did his doctorate on her life. Then she explained to the audience the most meaningful thing of her whole life. After she had this great success, one day someone came to her door. This is many years after she was abandoned. It was an 80-year-old man. He looked sickly. He was homeless. He was in total poverty. And he was begging her to help him. As they were talking, she recognized this was her husband who tried to kill her and rejected her mercilessly. He asked forgiveness. She forgave him. She said, "You could live in one of my orphanages, but not as a wife. Now you are my son, and I am your mother." And she introduced him to the other orphan children and said, "You should give him your love because he needs it the most." And when people come to her orphanage, sometimes she introduces him. "This is my eldest son. And he's very naughty." She told her story, and she concluded by explaining how, for all of us, there will be challenges, there will be traumas and crises. She said, "But we must stand above them so that they look small. We should always fight for truth. We should never lose our courage." She ended her little talk by saying, "The path of my life was full of thorns, but I made friends with those thorns, and my life became simple and beautiful." I was on my way to the airport, just about to leave Mumbai to come to the West. And usually it's at that time when people tell me the biggest problems I'm supposed to solve. So on this day, I said, please tell me an enlivening story. Because a good defense is a good offense. So one of the people in the car told me this story of Sindhu Dai. And the next year, I met her. There was a big event where we were both on stage together to address a large crowd of youth. But before the event, we met in a private home and just shared each other's hearts. I remember she said to me, you are like my Krishna. I said, well, then you are like my Radha. And she became really annoyed. She said, no, I am not Radha. I am Yashoda. That's Krishna's mother. But anyways, it was a beautiful discussion for about an hour. And then we were supposed to leave. And I got up. And I noticed, sitting right next to her, she brought some of her students. And there was a young lady who was, the whole time we were talking together, she didn't say a word. She was just smiling and beaming with joy and incredible light of energy. And she said, let me introduce you to this girl. She's one of my daughters. She's a medical doctor. She's now in charge of one of our orphanages. And then Sindhu Dai had tears in her eyes, and she smiled and said, she's the girl who was born under that cow. It's a simple but true story, which shows us how through her adversities, she not only grew, but she helped so many people grow. Just last year, there was an earthquake in Nepal, and some of those victims of the earthquake came to meet me. And they were telling me that when our Bhaktivedanta hospital came with food and medicine and everything, some of these people, they lost their family members, they lost their homes, they lost everything. But they found such great joy and meaning in their life by helping other people, by cooking, by having kirtan, by bringing doctors to meet them. You see, it's the nature of the world in any situation for anyone. We could see challenges. Why is this happening to me? And we can become very depressed, discouraged. But that's a choice. It may be completely justified, and we can really be sympathized for that situation. But some things happen that are just beyond our control. But still, we can choose to see it as an opportunity to deepen our connection to our own soul, to God, and understand how I could better serve others. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells that true fulfillment in life comes from within us. And when we make that connection, then we have a strong foundation that we can build our life on. If we don't have that inner fulfillment, then nothing externally will ever give us substantial happiness. The Bible tells, if you build a house on shifting sand. When a storm comes, the house will collapse, however beautiful it may be. But if you build a house on solid rock, whether it's a beautiful mansion or whether it's a little hut, it will withstand all the storms. So that foundation is the inner fulfillment, the inner peace, the inner love that we discover in our life. And this is a universal spiritual principle. The Vedanta Sutra tells Anandamayo Vyashat. Everyone is seeking fulfillment. We're all seekers of ras, or pleasure. But what is pleasure? In order to understand this properly, it's important that we understand who we are. The Gita tells, Na jayate mriyate vakadachit. This is beyond any sectarian concepts. It's a universal truth. That we are the living force that's within this body. We're seeing through our eyes and tasting through our tongue and hearing through our ears and thinking through our brain. We're loving through our heart. Bodies always change. From infancy to babyhood to childhood to adolescence to middle age to old age. Some of us here are in our 60s and 70s now, and we've seen this body going through so many changes. But we're the same person. When I remember myself as a little boy in Little League playing baseball, that was me. But actually, this body is much different. Nobody would even recognize a photograph of me at that time. And what to speak of the mind? When we were all little babies, what were we thinking about? We were crying desperately, totally focused, yearning for the milk of our mother. When was the last time you cried for the milk of your mother? When you're a little baby, could you even imagine what's in your mind today? You're an intel. So our mind is always changing at every moment. And our body's always changing. At every moment. Who am I? Who is the witness? We are that source of consciousness. Bible tells, what profiteth a person who gains the whole world but loses their eternal soul? And the Gita explains, Nahanyate hanyamane sarire, that the soul is beyond birth, beyond death. The soul is Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge, full of bliss. Inherently, Ananda, we are full of joy. To tap into that joy of our own true self is the greatest fulfillment. And when we make that connection within, then whatever we do through our words, through our life, with our family, through our occupation, we become instruments of a compassion that is beyond this ever-changing condition of the world around us. A meaningful life is not just what we get. It's what we give with what we have. We With us today is Shamsundar and Kanka, two of my dearest friends, my brother, my sister, my mother, my father. They are everything to me. And they witnessed our beloved spiritual teacher, Srila Prabhupada. You know, in the early days, he came to the West and he had no money. He was 70 years old. He just had heart attacks, a stroke, just upon arriving and on his way. He took a cargo ship for 38 days from Calcutta. So many tribulations. But he just saw every situation as an opportunity to do something good, to show his love for God and for others. And even most impossible situations that young people like Shamsundar was thinking, this is impossible, we should give up. He would say, no, no, this is a wonderful opportunity, don't you see? One little example, he was brought into this on a walk, and there was a ghetto, and they accidentally brought him to the Bowery in 1960s in New York City, and there was rats, and there was homeless people, and there was trash all over the place. And they said, we're so sorry we took you here. He said, oh, you don't see. This is the spiritual world. He was seeing an opportunity to serve. Where most people are depressed, he was seeing where there's the greatest need, there's the greatest opportunity to serve. In today's world, the tendency is so much to be distracted. Little things we take to be so important. We've all heard the analogy that you could make a grain of sand into a mountain, or you could see a mountain as a grain of sand. When we actually focus our attention on what's really important, then we see the things of this world in a perspective. It's very positive and beneficial. I'll end with a little analogy that I learned in a place called Rangakshetra in South India. There's a crane. A crane's a bird, a white bird with a long beak. And that crane stands on one leg in a stream of water and looks down into the stream. And little tiny fish are passing in the stream, and the crane just watches. Dozens of little fish, hundreds of little fish, thousands of little fish, just lets them pass. And then when a big fish comes, he eats it. No, I'm not telling you to eat fish. But cranes eat fish. The analogy is this. That intelligence is letting the little things pass in our life. We notice them. We deal with them. But we don't get caught up with the little things. We're always looking for the big issues. What's really important. And we feast on those big issues. If we don't have this higher purpose in life, then we'll be constantly diverted and exploited by all these little things. Little argument. Somebody says this, somebody does this. How many times do we get disturbed all this over these things? And even things that appear to be so relevant and so important, if we see it from the perspective of an eternal soul, if we see it from the perspective that we're all part of the one God, if we see it from the perspective of a whole life and the opportunities that we always do have, then we'll see in its proper perspective. It's very important that people help each other as friends, as parents of our children, to really remain focused on the really important issues of life, the beautiful opportunities we have in life, and not be consumed and distracted and depressed by all the little things that are just not going my way. In working places today, there's a lot of competition. There's a lot of challenges. Perhaps more than ever, in the working place today, things change so much. And in that change, there's so much vulnerability of people's lives. It's very important that we're in this world, but not of this world. That we have that strong spiritual connection. And we perform our work, perform our duties to our family, to our occupation, whatever that may be, from the point where we have a foundation of inner peace, inner fulfillment, and ultimately, the truest fulfillment, love. After I leave here, I'm going to Kanka's house. She lives in a redwood forest. Redwoods are the largest trees on earth. They're the tallest, they're the biggest, and some of the oldest. I've seen redwood trees that are 2,200 years old, according to scientists. I've seen redwood trees, one of them, 20 adults holding hands it takes to go around the tree. One tree, called the General Grant tree, in Kings Canyon, if you hollowed it out, you could put 159,000 basketballs. Or 2 million ping pong balls. And that tree is about 1,700 years old. Now some of these trees, they're growing in very loose ground, where there's earthquakes over the years, and there's massive storms, windstorms, snowstorms. How do they keep growing? They grow through every kind of adversity because of their roots. The redwood trees, their roots reach out to connect with other redwood trees, and they all interconnect. When two roots meet each other, they wrap around, embrace, and make a permanent bond. Every tree in the forest is directly or indirectly holding up every other tree. And in this way, through all the adversities of earthquakes and windstorms and hurricanes and whatever else comes, they just keep growing because they have strong roots. And they have a support system for their roots. As human beings, our roots are our hearts. When we connect to the root of our relationship with the Supreme, and when we reach out to serve, to care with compassion for others, then whatever may come in our life can grow in our happiness, in our enlightenment, and we can help others to grow as well. Thank you very much.
two question and answers. There's a small paper which is passed to you when you were entering, and you can write your question. For the first question, just raise your hand and tell your question, then we'll meet. Anyone else like to just start the first question? Yeah.
Thank you, Maharaj, for the wonderful words of wisdom. Truly a fantastic topic, seeing the need of the hour, how to grow in adversity. Sometimes we observe that in tremendous distress or pressures of life, despite our fight with the mind, it's very hard to focus. So can you please share some of your intel, how we can strengthen our foundation so that we are not disturbed amidst highest pressures also?
Through practice. In our tradition, there are three principles that are of such great benefit. One is satsang. Satsang means to be with people who enlighten us, who inspire us, who educate us in our spiritual quest. The second is satsang, to give some time each day. Sadhana means spiritual practice, giving time to actually make that inner connection with our true self and with God. By prayer, by meditation, in our tradition we chant God's names to make that inner connection. And when we find that inner fulfillment, which is beyond the ever-changing circumstances of this world, we realize that if our happiness is based on circumstances, then our happiness is very circumstantial. And it's without any real substance. But if we find our happiness in our own nature, in our own souls, then it can withstand any changes. And then we can actually be inner, we could be instruments of peace and love and happiness and enlightenment in whatever situation may come. I know a businessman in Mumbai. His family was one of the three biggest business houses in all of India years ago. But then due to policy changes of government and various interactions with international corporations and so forth, almost everyone in his business practically went bankrupt. It was really serious. So he had to reorganize everything. And it was so stressful, you can't even believe it. people who were in similar situations to him were really taking a lot of antidepressants. Many were just giving up. He was dealing with labor unions. He was dealing with government policies and taxes. He was dealing with liquidating huge properties. He was dealing with tens and thousands of employees. And he would come to our ashram every day, and he would just chant with us and pray with us, sing with us. And he always looked so happy. And he dealt with all this, and he brought the company through to become a very strong company again. He went through years of some of the most incredibly intense, impossible, stressful situations you can imagine in this world. And I remember I asked him, how'd you do that? And he said, because I'm with people who are helping so many others to love God. I see that my situation, whatever I'm dealing with, are all small things. I just have to do them. So he had good company. He had a good spiritual connection and sadachar. And he did, and he interacted with the challenges of this world with integrity, with character, and with compassion. And actually, every one of us could do that. It's just a choice. Does that answer your question?
This is another question, Maharaj.
Yes.
The question says that there are people call themselves as atheist rationalists, and they spread the propaganda that modern humans does not need spirituality and religion because these are superstitious, including Vastu, astrology, and others. So how do we understand and how do we break through this false propaganda? So that's the question.
Hari Hari. If someone tells you that there's no such thing as the sun planet at noon on a cloudless day, and you look up at the sun and they present so many arguments why there is no sun, what will you say? I feel the sun, I see the sun. So people could say whatever they want. But spirituality is not just about theory and concepts, it's about experience. When we experience the light of God's love within us, we understand it's beyond a sectarian idea. When we feel God's love and it fills us, there's no reality so sweet, so beautiful, and so real. And spiritual paths or religions are meant to just connect us to that so that we can have that experience and share it with others. I'll tell a little story I told the other day. I was in New York City at the Rubin Museum, and I gave a lecture. About 150 people in an auditorium. And after I came down from the stage, I had to sign books, and the museum was closing in a half hour, so they were really rushing. Because museums are, they close their doors and lock them at a certain time. So they were saying, you have to come up right away. So I came off the stage and this one very distinguished man approached me. He was about my age, 60s. He was an American man. He had a little trimmed gray beard and gray hair, actually white. And he spoke with, he was obviously extremely educated. He was a scientist. And he said to me, I have some questions for you. I liked your lecture, but I have some questions. And I said, but I really have to go. I said, why don't we walk and talk together on the way up to the book table? And he said, from my earliest childhood, I am a staunch atheist. I cannot accept the misconception of a God. I have seen in my life hatred, arrogance, violence, and so many divisions of our human society in the name of God. I reject God. And I've studied so many scientific arguments against God, and so many philosophical principles that disprove God. That was his question. I said, actually, everything you just said is what I used to think, too. Because I've seen all that hatred and violence and judgmentalism and arrogance in the name of God. But when I was young, I came to a conclusion in my own life that either I have to reject spirituality and religion, or there must be something very beautiful, the essence of all of them. And I believe that there was something at the essence of all true spiritual paths that was common. And in my quest, I found my own life. And through the various great spiritual literatures I've read and the saints that I met of these traditions, that beyond this power and fear that religions sometimes invoke, there is sweetness, the sweetness of God's love, the beauty of God's love, the joy of God's love. And that's what I discovered is at the heart of all great spiritual life. That's. And then we came to the book table, and I had to say goodbye to him, because there was about 100 people waiting in line, and we only had about 10 minutes to sign everyone's books. So it was kind of a rush at that point, and I had to say goodbye to him. And as I shook his hand, and as I was shaking his hand, I said something, which, I don't know why I said it. I said, God bless you. And I was thinking when I said that, why did I say that to him? He hates God. And there was a pause for a second, and as he was shaking my hand, with great emotion, he responded, God bless you, sir. And then he became very emotional. He said, I've never said that to anyone in my entire life. And it felt so good. So because there is so much sentimentalism and superstition and arrogance in the name of religion, oftentimes very thoughtful persons do question it. But those who are saragrahi, those who really go to seek the essence, logically, philosophically, and through experience, the beauty and the sweetness and the unifying power of God's love. And meeting people who have that connection can give us a higher experience.
I guess that answered the question, whoever had it. We are running out of time. Would like to take one more question? If not, let's thank His Holiness Radhanath Swami for visiting here and blessing us with these words of wisdom and inspiration at the right time. And if you want Radhanath Swami to come again, let's give a big hand. He has been seeked into so many institutions and has so much tight schedule. We would like to express our deep gratitude for Radhanath Swami to come here and bless us with His wisdom. Thank you.